9 a.m.-ish on March 6, 2013, and you're listening to Good Morning Atlanta, sponsored by World Trade Center Atlanta on Business Radio X, a proud 2013 member of Central Atlanta Progress. Learn more about Central Atlanta Progress at atlantadowntown.com. I'm Dana Barrett, and normally my co-host Elizabeth chimes in right at this moment and says, "And I'm Elizabeth Gordon." Of course, she doesn't say it like that, but that's what she says. And she walks in right after I made fun of her. Nicely done. Okay, breezing into the studio, celebrity Elizabeth Gordon will be joining us on the air in just a second. And meanwhile, in the studio, we have three guests today. I'm very excited to have three new members of the World Trade Center Atlanta joining us, Dan Bradbury, John West, and Robert Stevens. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Full house today. We had an interesting morning, as always, around here. Getting into the building is sometimes a challenge, but we make it happen. We get on the air. We get things going. Elizabeth has these great sunglasses. She looks like a total rock star. I love it. Hi, Elizabeth.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good to see you.
Good to see you.
Good to see everyone.
So before we get into interviewing our wonderful guests, who have all kinds of amazing businesses to talk about, international things and security and technology and books and we've got a lot of stuff to talk about. We have some headlines to go through, as always. I picked a random smattering today. Smattering a word? Anybody? Anybody?
It's yes. Used.
It's used? Okay, counts then. Good enough. It's like schmutz. Okay, so the first story I picked out was just, we like to talk about, you know, growth here in Atlanta when there's new projects going on, new jobs. So I wanted to just make a note that Atlanta developer Carter is planning a $40 million mixed-use project in downtown Decatur, which will include more than 200 high-end apartments. So it's interesting to me, first of all. Well, first of all, Decatur is a great little town. I don't know. Where you, what part of town are you guys all from?
Primarily Buckhead.
Primarily? Do you have more than one location?
Yes.
Dan? What about you?
I'm in the suburbs in Ackworth.
Ackworth. You drove in here today, didn't you?
I did.
All right. That's Robert talking, by the way. And John, where are you from?
And I'm in Atlanta, just right west of the airport.
All right. But so we've all been to Decatur, right? Have you guys gone over
there? Many times, many times. Great downtown area.
Yeah. I mean, it's really one of the most vibrant downtown.
It definitely is a great place. I always take people when they come to visit from out of town.
Yes.
We spend a day in Decatur because you can spend a whole day there.
You can. There's great shops, great restaurants. It's a really cool little area. Though I have to say, on a side note, and we'll get back to Decatur in a second, that I went to downtown Norcross, historic Norcross, the other day for a meeting, and it was really cool. I used to live over there when I first moved to Atlanta when I was a lot younger, and there wasn't much to it, but it has really come a long way. There's some really great-looking restaurants over there, cafes and little shops, and so if anyone's driving around, I suggest checking that out, too. Straight up Peachtree Industrial,
right.
Really. It's really easy to get to.
So it's great to see people making investments in these nice, like, small town areas
that we
have scattered around all of Atlanta, the greater metro area, which makes it really one of the, I mean, that's one of the great selling points of this city.
You know, coming from the Northeast, as I do, and my friend Elizabeth here does as well, although we've both been here a long time, one of the things that was missing from here is sort of that down, you know, that really kind of in-town walkable feel. And these neighborhoods that are little in-town neighborhoods that are sort of cropping up all over the place, I think are adding some of that back to this area, which I think is great.
And there's so much history around the metro area.
Yeah.
This building we're in, 200 Peachtree, the old Macy's building, so much history, and so glad to see that they were able to renovate it to be such a beautiful facility.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things about sort of American real estate development all over the place, not just here in Atlanta, is that for a long time, and this has dramatically changed in probably the last 10 years or 20 years, I don't know, but we were just building things and then sort of abandoning them and going on to something else and building something else and going to it and leaving the old stuff sort of looking crappy and crumbling and, you know, not caring about it. And that has dramatically changed. I feel like there's a big shift to get back into the cities, to rejuvenate areas, to take advantage of some of that history you mentioned, Robert. And I think that's awesome.
Yes.
I mean, I think it really is what we should have been doing all along. It's really sad when you drive down roads kind of like where I grew up, it was Baltimore Pike, which was Route 1 outside Philly. And, you know, here it's sometimes on Buford Highway or, you know, some of the on 41 in some spots where it's just like these shopping centers that were new and great at one point and now they're just ugh.
Dead.
Yeah. So
right, or abandoned car dealerships.
Oh, those are fascinating.
If someone could come up with a way to redevelop
those. Turn them into something
that
cool.
That would change America.
I think you're right. Well, cars aren't going anywhere, so that's hopefully there
won't be... but people are buying them online now instead of spending all day Saturday at the dealership.
Dickering, is that a word too?
Right, and you can buy a car at Costco, which blew my mind.
Shut up.
Yes.
Dan, really?
Yes. Costco, you can go and buy a car.
Seriously. But they don't have, how does that work? They don't have them on the lot or anything. You just
pick them out from a catalog.
Whoa.
And you put them on order. That's true.
I did not know that. All right. Well, I guess.
You better know what you really want if you do that.
Though I have to tell you, even this 7 years ago or 8 years or something when I bought my last car, I looked around online. Even then, I knew what I wanted, and I knew exactly what I wanted, John. So to your point, and I looked around at I went to the dealership here. They gave me a price. I wasn't satisfied with what they said. So I looked around online, and I found a dealership in Florida that would give me a better price. And I was going down there anyway to visit my mom. And so I just drove my old car, went to that dealership, traded it in, and drove my new one home. Done and done.
No dickering around?
No dickering. It was all the dickering. I did all the dickering on the phone before I got down there. And we had a deal so that when I got there, all I had to do was sign the paperwork and go. It was great. So yeah, you're right. I mean, it is moving more and more towards online. And
speaking of which, there's actually a used car dealer chain expanding in Georgia.
Oh yeah?
America's Car Mart.
That sounds classy.
Yeah. Well, it's headquartered in Bentonville, Arkansas. So that is a hub of class.
Be real careful with used cars these days with Sandy. There are thousands of cars that are flooded.
Oh, good point. I never even thought about
very
that.
Very careful.
Well, and you know, is that like when, you know how in TV and movies, you know, when like people are on the run and they stop at like the crappy car dealer and like buy a car right off the lot for cash or whatever? Is
right.
that what this place
and
is like?
And then go rob a bank?
Right.
Isn't that
that's, where
that
I, that's where I was going.
Goes.
Yeah, totally. That's totally where I was headed.
My next car is not going to take a drop of gas.
Okay. Electric?
Going all electric, huh?
Or natural gas, one
something.
Of the two.
All right, I like it. Well, while we're on cars, let's talk about a subject we talked about last week, which is the left lane slowpoke bill, which cracked me up. It cracked me up. Last week, I was like, really? Is this what our legislators are spending their time on? I mean, I realize it's annoying when people are driving slow in the left lane, but really? Come on. Just give them the finger, beep at them, and move on with your life. Like, really? Come on.
And slow
we
in the
need
left
legislation
lane
for this? Yeah.
I mean,
slows like 65 miles an hour.
Well, and that's the funny thing is like any law you pass can't actually resolve the problem because it would require you to break the law, the other law, the speed limit law. So it is, anyway, the new headline this week was that and I love the way they wrote this headline, left lane slowpoke bill hits roadblock. Wah, wah.
Welcome to Georgia.
Yeah. So basically it's looking like this bill is going to kind of fizzle and die, and that'll be the end of that. But I just thought it was so ridiculous that we are spending time talking about it. People in the newspaper are spending time writing about it. Our legislators are spending time trying to write bills. Like, so you know this guy that wrote the bill, who is, let's see if it says here who he is. Representative Bill Hitchens, Republican from Rincon. Where the heck is Rincon? Anyway, he was driving down the road and somebody pissed him off, and that's where this whole thing came from. You know it. Right? Or one of his constituents was. And they were like, Bill!
You got to do something about this.
I'm not giving you money next year unless you get this fixed, you know? Come on.
But it's obviously a slow news day when that makes the press.
I mean, it's just, I love talking about stuff like that because it's just, this is the kind of stuff when you're just the average citizen and you don't necessarily read all the small stories every day that you don't even know that this is what's going on. Like, this is the crap that actually people are spending their time on. It's just amazing. He wrote a bill. Like, he sat down and wrote a bill. Look, can we just absorb that for a minute? He wrote a bill. All right. Moving on. I love this story, too. Lawyer charged after not returning ring found at Cracker Barrel. So, did you hear the story?
I saw that, too, but she returned it.
Well, okay. So the gist of the story is that I got was that this lawyer was in the parking lot of a Cracker Barrel, and she saw this ring on the ground, and she's a public attorney. She's like a defense attorney or something like that. And or works for the district. No, she doesn't work for the, I think she's a public defender. Anyway, she finds this ring, and whoever she was with went back into the Cracker Barrel and said, what do we do if we find something of value like this? And they said, well, you know, you can give it to us, we'll put it in lost and found, or I guess you can keep it and go report it to the police and let them know and they'll handle it. And she said, okay, that's what we're going to do. So she kept it, did not report it to the police. And it laid low for a minute. And a couple days go by. And the person who lost it went back to the Cracker Barrel, said, I lost this ring. They remembered somebody saying that they had found it. So they then went to the police and discovered that it had not been reported. Okay. And in the meantime, I guess this person or the police or whoever put out an online discussion. Hey, we're missing this ring, Cracker Barrel parking lot, this date, yada, yada, yada. That's when she came forward and said, oh, I have it here. Right. So it, because of the value of the ring, it was like a $10,000 ring. First of all, who leases a $10,000 ring? What were they doing with it in the parking lot? But okay, that's a side note. But it's kind of interesting because how many times have you found something like, you know, a $20 bill or something and been like, I'll keep it, you know? like if you turn it in, you know the people you turn it into are just going to keep it.
What are they going to do? How do you know?
Right. And I mean, to be honest, I lost a valuable piece of jewelry like that one time and I have no idea where I lost it. And I'm quite sure somebody kept it. Like I dropped it outside somewhere, I'm pretty sure, and never to be found again. Somebody should be charged with a but the thing is,
finders keepers.
Well, that's what I wanted to talk. Why I wanted to talk about it because we are raised that way as kids. It's a poem: finders keepers, losers weepers.
My conscience wouldn't let me keep anything that isn't mine for 1 second. I have to just get rid of it. I'd give it to Cracker Barrel and
let them deal with it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that would have been the right thing. That would have been the best thing to do. I mean, I could see feeling like, well, maybe the Cracker Barrel wouldn't do the right thing with it, so I'm going to take it to the authorities. But
it
didn't.
Fits, and it looks so nice.
Well, and her lawyer is arguing that she never wore it. She never represented it as hers. She didn't do it. She didn't try to sell it, like that she literally just hadn't gotten around to reporting it yet. But meanwhile, because of the value of it, she's being charged. I just thought it was kind of interesting because, I mean, John, you know, a lot of people are like you and have, you know, a conscience like that and would do the right thing, but a lot of people don't.
Well, I had a similar instance. I found a high school class ring on my son's baseball field, gosh, probably 5 years ago. Took a few weeks before I was able to track it down on the internet, the inscription on the inside. Turns out it was a high school in Shreveport, Louisiana. Contacted the school. 9 months later, they contacted me back.
Wow.
And told me the guy's name, who turns out was a neighbor two blocks over.
Wow.
But in that time had gotten divorced, moved away.
Oh, gosh.
Unlisted number. Tried to reach out through his son, through his ex-wife.
Wow.
Nothing. So his class ring is sitting on my credenza waiting for somebody to contact me to give it back to him. And it's been 5 years now.
Wow. Okay. Anyone listening who knows?
George Cleotis, if you're listening, I have your class ring.
You know what we should do is we should take that and we should put it in the post for the show. And so then Google, maybe if when somebody Googles his name, it'll you know,
pop up.
You never know. That 5 more years, you'll get a call.
Maybe so.
And by that point, you'll be like, I melted it down and sorry. Anyway, I just find it interesting because you do sort of think of, I never really thought there was a law about keeping something that you found. Because certainly this lawyer didn't go out of her way to steal the ring. She just, you know, tripped over it. So I don't know. It's kind of interesting. So be careful, people. Let that conscience of yours.
You see something sparkly, you just keep walking.
Keep walking. Keep on trucking. All right, Elizabeth. It's time for a list. I love lists. I like to do top 10s, top 15s, top 20s. And this one is especially for my friend Elizabeth because it's about beer. She likes a good beer from now and again, right?
Who doesn't?
Me.
Oh, come on. So anyway, the list today is about America's best beer gardens, and Atlanta makes the list. So I thought I would share that because for those of you who like beer, Dear Beer Garden in Atlanta makes the list of top 10 put together by Yahoo Travel. And by Food and Wine magazine, it got picked up by Yahoo Travel. So that's a national list.
There weren't that many.
No, and they're all 10. Pretty cool. Like the number one is Beer Garden in San Francisco. Sheffield's in Chicago makes the list. Beraria in New York City. Bohemian Hall and Beer Garden in Queens, New York. Easy Tiger in Austin, Texas. Then us, Dear Beer Garden in Atlanta. Sweet Cheeks Q in Boston. Drury Beer Garden in Philadelphia. That's for me and Elizabeth also. Lowry Beer Garden in Denver. And Stone Brewing World and World Bistro and Gardens in San Diego. So that's kind of cool to be on that list.
Me and Public House isn't on that list?
It is not.
I'm surprised.
But you can get a beer there.
Yes, you can, right downstairs.
That's right. Exactly. So the cool thing about this is, you know, whenever we make the sort of national travel spots, that's always a good thing because we like to get tourists coming here to the city of Atlanta. And, you know, the more places we can get that kind of national reputation or world reputation even, all the better. I don't really drink beer either. I mean, I'll have one occasionally if that's all there is. What happened with me is, on the subject of beer, you guys can join in because I think we're all, you know, over a certain age, I'm just going to say. It used to be pretty simple, you know, like you got a Heineken or like a Coors or like a Miller Lite or something. Like Heineken was like going fancy, you know. And now you go into these places and there are like 30,000 different beers to choose from. And there's like fruity beers and brown beers and dark beers and light beers. And I don't even know wheat this. And I'm so confused by beer that I can't do it. I can't drink it. It's too much to choose from.
No, you're right. You walk into these craft beer bars.
Yeah.
And there are hundreds.
Yeah.
Hundreds of selections.
How
there.
The hell do you pick one? Do you but just like wave your finger over the menu and go, I'll take that one? Because
I've done that before.
I think you almost have to. Because how the heck can you possibly, Elizabeth, you drink more beer. How do you know how to pick them?
You look through the menu and you decide which one you want to try.
Based on what? Like, blah, 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 blah.
What you're, like, what you have a taste for. Okay. I guess as you become more of a connoisseur, you have an understanding of what you're trying to taste for.
See, and I don't have
that. And enjoy, because they're very different. So sometimes you want something light. Sometimes you want something fruity. Sometimes you're in the mood for something dark. It's right.
I mean, you just walk up to
the
bartender.
Depends on the weather.
I
the meal you're eating.
We have a new business for you. I think you can educate people like me on how to handle all these places, because I had a hard enough time learning which wine to order, and now I have to go back and learn how to do the beers. So
you're always safe in walking up to the bartender and say, I would like a nice pale ale.
Because then you sound like you know what you're doing.
Right.
And it's pretty safe. Like, it tastes sort of like what we used to drink back in the day. All right.
Mine's simple. I always just choose A&W.
I had a fruity one not too long ago. I was out with my sisters. They're much cooler than I am. They're younger. And so I just decided, like, oh, okay, I'll try this fruity thing. And it was actually really good. But they didn't used to have fruity beers back in the day. Whatever. Anyway, Beer Garden in Atlanta. Go there. Awesome. Last news report story for the day, if you can even call this a news report. Bank of America rolling out a new rewards card for responsible debtors. Which I kind of enjoy, because basically what they're saying is you get points, you get rewards if you pay your bill on time and you pay more than the minimum. So if you're responsibly managing your debt, they're rewarding you, which is like a first, because normally they will like smack you down the minute you make a mistake. I mean, you know, all that good months of goodness you get no credit for. And then that 1 month where you screw it up, man, they are like on you, you know, like
here comes the late fee.
Oh, my gosh. And you always call, like, I've done this, and I know my friends have done this, but you call and you're indignant. You're like, I have been a good customer for 20 years, and I missed 1 month, and now you're phone calling me and harassing me and charging me $50 in late fees and all this craziness. And finally, they're saying, well, all right, we're going to do something nice for you if you're a good customer. So we'll see how that goes. I think I have a Bank of America credit card, so I wonder if I'll start getting all kinds of great rewards. Thoughts? Anyone? No.
I think you're going to have to apply for the new card.
Oh, it's
a
special card?
Card, right?
Oh,
that's going to say, hey, that's
new
so
annual fee.
That's how they're going to get you, right?
Bastards. All right. Well, it was a good theory. I would like my existing cards to reward me for being awesome. Could that happen? Anybody? No?
Probably not.
No. Mm-hmm. All right. Nope. All right. Well, let's move on from the nonsense to the important stuff, which is our lovely gentleman in the room. And, we're just going to start. This is non-visual for the people listening, but for me, we're just going to start at the left. So, Dan, tell us about you. Just give us the short, and then we'll dig in.
Okay, I'll give you the elevator speech.
Yes.
Yes. Now, I'm originally from Atlanta, and started a management consulting company here a long time ago, a project management specialization, sold it, and then got into biotech and pharmaceutical investing.
Okay.
And then saw some of the antiquated ways in which funding was raised, et cetera. And I started what is now my current business, which is a secure online document exchange company. We do a lot of international transactions, and I call it Dropbox on steroids from a security standpoint.
Okay. So explain that a little bit. Like, who needs that? Who does it benefit? How do they use it?
This is used a lot by investment bankers, by attorneys. Whenever you have extremely secure confidential corporate information that needs to be exchanged with parties outside your firewall, outside your computer system,
right,
then you're able to upload this information into a VROOM. That's the name of the company, is VROOMS, V-R-O-O-M-S. And it provides a private cloud in which that information can be very securely shared, controlled, stored, and you also get tracking and auto reports on who has looked at what information.
So when you're talking to a prospect, let's say, who's thinking about getting this, because I feel like everybody in a way, I feel like I personally would like to have that. Obviously, I can't afford, I'm sort of do it as an individual. But, you know, when you think about sending somebody the password to something or your social security number, every time you do it, you're like, oh, but my question is, when you're talking to a prospect and about this, how do you ensure that it is secure? Like, what are you telling them about the technology so they know it's truly secure?
Right. It meets a number of, let's say, international certifications.
Okay.
You know, as using Dropbox, for instance, it's a very popular program out there that is now found its way inside the corporation, but also at the peril of a lot of the IT managers who look at it and say, well, you're actually using a personal document exchange program here for very sensitive corporate information. So we have lots of security protocols, lots of security checklists. I mean, things that are really kind of behind the scenes that only a very knowledgeable IT manager or a CIO, you know, would understand that, okay, if you put information into our firewall protected vault, so to speak, then that information is not really accessible by those who are not supposed to see it.
Okay. So if I have your product, or I am, is it a subscription type thing?
Right, it's a month-to-month subscription or an annual subscription.
Okay. So if I have a subscription and I'm putting my documents up there and I want to share them with Elizabeth and she doesn't have a subscription, how does that work?
Oh, no. Merely all you have to do is provide her with a username and password.
Okay.
And in that username and password, you can establish, you know, what level of documents that she can look at, the documents that she does look at, can she download them, can she print them, can she save them, can she look at them one time, access to this document is going to expire after a certain date. So you even have the ability to unshare information that you put out there where at a certain point in time you can pull the access to that information back and they no longer have access to it.
Okay, interesting.
People are using their phones and tablets and some combination thereof more and more as we move more to a mobile environment. Dan, how is this impacting what you guys are doing with V-Rooms?
No, it really is. That's what's fueling this entire push. We were in the cloud computing, the online document exchange business before it was known as the cloud. Back is known as SaaS, software as a service. And as things are moving more and more mobile, this has really fueled the need for this type of repository that is sitting in a private cloud. You mentioned smartphones and tablets, and I saw a term here just within the last week called a phablet, P-H-A-B-L-E-T.
That sounds fab.
Fab. and I was intrigued because now some of the smartphones are getting large. I mean, they're on that border between, is it a smartphone or is it a tablet? But it's a very, very large, smartphone. And so now it is called a phablet.
I like that.
Yes. But, I mean, all of this is really just fueling the
I think that's just for us old people that need glasses. We have bigger phones. We don't have to worry about looking at that tiny little print.
Larger font is much better there.
It's a beautiful thing. Continue. Yeah. I'm sorry.
It really has. It's just fueled this entire need for online secure access to very confidential information. And we see that trend continuing. I mean, as things are even moving away from a PC-based or personal computer-based communications and now into the iPads, into the iPhones, into the smartphones, the tablets, all of these are totally dependent upon some type of outside cloud storage because you don't have a hard disk drive on those devices. So you have to go outside to access this. And the ability to do this in a very, very secure environment is absolutely critical.
Is there first of all, let me ask you where the name V-Rooms came from.
Oh, V-Rooms. That's really kind of a holdover from the start of the industry, a virtual data room. Back in the olden days, and when I say olden days in the technology world, this was 10 years ago.
I was going to say, it was like last year.
Yes, back in the real olden days.
Right.
But a company going through a merger and acquisition, the seller would oftentimes take the due diligence information, which may consist of 20 boxes of contracts, agreements, et cetera. They would haul them over to their local attorney's office there, take out a conference room, and then over the next 3 to 4 weeks invite the bidders, the potential buyers, to come in and look through the documents. So a potential buyer A would come into the due diligence war room, hence the name The Room.
Okay.
They would come into the room, and so the buyer or potential buyer's attorneys and accountants would come in, and for days they would plow through the contracts, the agreements. Here, take a make a copy of this, make a copy of this. So a lot of smoke around the room, you know, a lot of coffee stains all over the place. And so then eventually it became an accepted fact to just, why not scan this information and put it into a very secure website where you can access this simultaneously by multiple individuals. But this is where the whole concept of The Room came from, was from the due diligence physical war room that was back in the M&A merger and acquisition days.
Interesting. So I had another question I was going to ask before I asked you about the name. I got sidetracked because I was intrigued. But when you're dealing with your clients, are you dealing primarily with really large corporations? Is it all size businesses? Do you have different subscription levels? Talk to me a little bit about who can use this.
Right. It's on totally different subscription levels, and it can range from a transaction that maybe only be in place for, you know, 3, 4, or 5 months or something, and therefore you have like a month-to-month subscription.
Okay.
But as we're getting into larger corporations and enterprise requirements, what we often find is we're brought into a large corporation for the benefit of a project, but then they start to see the utility of the program for another project and another department in another area over there. So the corporations will then just bring us in on an annual basis and just buy a package, so right. to speak, and then start to make that available to their different departments for a whole range of different projects, everything from engineering to sales marketing. But whenever they're needing to push out confidential information, maybe to their staff even around the world, because all of this is accessible through just a web browser.
Right. So now, how big of a company is your company?
We have about 15 people on board, primarily headquartered in Atlanta, but also in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. And I like to tell people that we provide 24/7 around the world customer support, and about 30% of our business now is international.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. But when I say that we provide U.S.-based customer support, I said our support people may talk a little bit slower, but they're from Texas, but you can understand what they're saying.
We won't necessarily go there, but I think we hear you, Dan. I think we hear what you're saying.
I understand.
As people who have all been on the phone with customer service people, we cannot understand. How long have you guys been in business in this format?
Right, and started this company 7 years ago.
Okay.
Right, so we were kind of on the early wave of the acceptance of cloud computing, and have definitely been able to ride that wave and continue to ride it.
What's your forecast for growth? What do you see happening over the next couple of years?
Oh, I see, you know, phenomenal growth, you know, in the range of, you know, 200-400%. I mean, because the market is there. The market is expanding not proportionally, but just extraordinarily.
Yeah.
Just the acceptance of the whole concept. And so we're walking in the door with a proven, documented, so far, knock on the wood, bulletproof security-wise platform that people can depend on.
Interesting. And how do you deal with the ever-changing technology world? How do you stay on top of new developments?
It's constantly reviewing what's coming out there in the way of Google alerts. I mean, those things, the press releases, the things that are happening out there, and also just beefing up our internal development staff.
Yeah.
I mean, that is really key right there, of having key individuals on board who understand and can take concepts and translate them into code and then put them into an application all in the matter of a few weeks that then addresses a need in the marketplace.
Right. There's a couple things I want to talk to you about before we leave you and go on to these other gentlemen. One is, if people are looking to participate, if they want to join, subscribe, learn more about V-Rooms, how do they find you?
Oh, sure. We're easily found on the internet at www.v-rooms.com. Yeah, v-rooms.com. There's all the information that you need to know to get things started.
Awesome. And you wrote a book. Tell me about your book.
Yes. Book I wrote about 6 years ago. Name of the book is Herding Chickens, Innovative Techniques for Project Management.
Okay.
That is herding, H-E-R-D-I-N-G, not H-U-R-T-I-N-G. not hurting chickens, but herding chickens, like similar to herding cats. But after I sold my project management business, which was based here in Atlanta, it was about 150-person project management consulting firm. We worked with Fortune 500 companies, et cetera. But I was approached by a publisher to write a book on project management. And I said, okay, well, I'll write a book, but I'm not going to write, you know, a 300-page tome over there that is boring and just everything else that, you know, textbooks tend to be. I said, okay, I'll put together a book that's based on war stories, events, and it's going to have a very humorous overtone to it, but there'll be some real lessons inside there. And so hence the title, Herding Chickens, Innovative Techniques for Project Management. And the book has done very well. We've gotten a lot of good reviews, and it's surprisingly international. A lot of Japanese organizations and companies have actually picked up the book. I guess they know something about herding chickens, you know, herding cats, innovative techniques for managing projects and people.
Well, they're actually trying to run chicken farms, and they're just confused. That's why they're buying the book.
Maybe that's what it is.
Just kidding, Dan. Just trying to keep it light here.
I understand.
Is there anything else you want to share before we move on?
Not really.
Okay.
But it's kind of interesting. As one goes through a career, you see how one door opens and another door closes. And this is the point I wanted to make. And, you know, what's the correlation between project management, herding chickens, and the company that I currently have is that, you know, it's a segue. As in the project management field, we saw the need to share information outside the team, you know, for a particular project, you know, and hence, you know, roll forward a few years. And then all of a sudden, you know, the V-Rooms, you know, secure document sharing developed as a company. You have to serve a need where there was just an opening there and an idea many years ago.
You know, I think that's a really good point, because I think all of us in our careers, things have changed. You know, obviously it's not our country, the world anymore is not where you go and get a job in one industry or one company and you stay there for 50 years and then you retire. That's just not how it works anymore. Most of us have shifted careers. Some dramatically, some less dramatically over our lives. And we have to raise our kids that way. I mean, that's the way the world is going. So I think that's a really interesting point, because it's sort of all about, I think, something that kids coming out of college almost need to know is you have to keep your mind open and keep the blinders off, right? Because you were in one career, but there was a need that you saw that wasn't exactly what you were doing, but it's related.
Exactly.
And you transition your experience, you transition your knowledge, and you apply it to the next project. And I think, as employers, we need to understand that when we're looking to hire, that people aren't necessarily fitting into the boxes anymore that they used to, but that breadth of experience is great.
Yeah, but let me add also that 100% of the ideas I've ever had have worked 100% of the time. I'm kidding.
I was going to say, that's really impressive, Dan.
No, so you know, be willing to accept those things that are not going according to plan, those things that wind up just being blatant failures,
sure,
and then pick up and go on quickly.
Right. And not to segue on blatant failures, but let's move over. Let's move over to Robert. Robert, you are the managing partner at CFO Navigator.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about you.
Well, you know how a business reaches that tween or teen stage where they're too big to be small, but they're too small to be big. They know they need to pay closer attention to their numbers, but they just don't have that financial horsepower to do so. Well, as a fractional CFO, I help these companies navigate the numbers that drive their business.
All right, fractional CFO. I like that. Explain.
Fractional as opposed to an interim.
Okay.
And Dan and I were speaking before the show about the difference. An interim CFO will come in for an interim period,
right,
hence the term,
yeah,
where they will perform as a CFO for a project. For example, they may be hired as a permanent CFO or stay on until one is hired.
Gotcha.
I'm a fractional CFO. I come into my clients between 1 and 2 days a month. They have controllers, accountants, they have their own department to do the day-to-day. I'll come in and I essentially do three things. First is rear view mirror stuff, which 95% of every CPA, CFO, accountant out there will do. That's look in the rearview mirror, tell you where you've been, balance sheet, income statement, just the basic financial statement.
So you're reviewing sort of what's been happening for the last month.
Right.
Since you were there.
Review with the controller. Did they do all the debits and credits, accruals, you know, all the technical accounting stuff that the business owner has no idea about. Make sure that the numbers are right. And then from there, move to what I call windshield view. Looking forward, anticipating. What does it mean? Here are the numbers, boss, here's the financials. OK, okay, what does it mean? That's usually when I'm brought in, when the controller doesn't really understand.
They can do the books, but they can't close it,
but they can't interpret it.
Yeah.
So that's kind of where I provide value, isn't that forward-looking? Here's what it means going forward. And then the third leg of my stool, as I say, is coaching controllers. And I kind of fell into that through working with them. Almost all of my clients have controllers that have been with them for years, decades in some cases. They love them. They trust them completely. They don't want to get rid of them, but they're not getting what they need out of them. They need more. And honestly, they just don't have the experience. So in doing the rearview mirror and the windshield stuff, I coach them, help them understand kind of what they need to be working on, where they need to be looking, trying to turn them into navigators. In fact, my BHAG, when I started my practice, was to change the perception of accountants from bean counters to business navigators.
Okay.
So I try to do that through coaching the controllers of my clients.
So Robert, give us an example of the types of insights that you're able to garner by taking that type of approach and, you know, from a forward thinking perspective. So as a business owner, what should I be trying to navigate through my numbers and see so that I can figure out which way I want to steer the ship?
The biggest missing link in my clients is an understanding to be able to get down to the numbers, an understanding of the operational drivers and how that relates to the numbers, to the end scorecard, the financial statements. By my understanding what their handful of primary drivers are, I can, through modeling and a bunch of boring Excel spreadsheets that I do, can tie those together and help them ask the what ifs. What if we take on this big account? What if we hire this new salesperson? If these assumptions happen as we think they will happen, here's what it will look like financially on our financial statements in 6, 12, 24 months down the road.
I could use that with my home financing. What if I buy this new rug? What will that do to my finances, Robert? How long have you been doing this and how did you get here?
Great question. I've had my practice for going into 4 years.
Okay.
2009, I started it after being the CFO of a management consulting company. It was a South African-owned U.S. subsidiary. We grew rapidly to almost $25 million before the economy turned south. And when it did, you know, the large clients, you know, their consulting dollars dried up. And I had that lunch with the CEO of, thank you for all you've done, appreciate your help, but we can't afford you anymore.
Love that lunch.
So that's when I kind of had the opportunity to think about what do I want to do. And a common thread throughout my career has been working with growth companies, sometimes literally startups. They grew to 25, 35 million, where I've been the first accountant in, where I've set up everything from taking software out of a box, creating the GL, putting all the financials measurements in place, hiring the staff. I've done that consistently. And through the 20 plus years I've been doing that, the companies that grew fast were sold. Upon being sold, accounting, HR, IT, duplicate functions, you know, you're on to the next one.
Get that lunch again.
So I had that lunch like a couple of times. And the last time kind of looked around and said, I can do this instead of for one client, one employer, I can do it for multiple. And so today I have a half a dozen clients that I come in and see, like I said, between 1 and 2 days a month.
Now, I was waiting to see if Elizabeth was going to ask an insightful question, but she's looking at me the same way. So, so when you're talking about companies that are, you said, like teens and tweens, what does that actually mean size-wise? How big are these companies generally?
So my clients are anywhere from 2 to 20 million. The sweet spot is 5 to 15. That's when they really start bumping up against that ceiling of what we've done before isn't working. Wheels are falling off. They need better processes. They need more solid infrastructure, things that can be scaled because they're growing. And there's certain points in business where you realize that what got you here won't get you there, but you don't know what to do.
Now, I think of companies, some of that size, of as having a CFO. Are these just companies that are not ready to spend that annual salary?
Typically.
Okay.
And in my experience, it's when they get close to 20 million. And again, it depends on the industry. But typically, when they approach 20 million, they can, one, afford it, and two, they really need it.
Yeah.
And that's what I tell my clients. When you want to stick your head out of the office and yell Robert down the hall and I'm not there, it's probably time to think about bringing on someone full time.
Right. But that's not even something you want to do at this point. That's like what you're doing.
That's correct.
Yeah.
And I've had a couple of offers to,
yeah, I'm
to
sure.
do that over the years.
Because you're in there and they trust you. And
exactly. Yeah. Which is gratifying.
Yeah.
I appreciate it very much. but I tell them so. And in some cases, help them find that.
I was going to say, you'd probably be
a
good guy to know for all the CFOs that are looking for work.
You know? I do have insights. And in fact, today I'm a sole practitioner.
Yeah.
I rather enjoy that at the moment.
Sure.
But I do see potential, because there's only so much that I can carry on my own shoulders.
Right.
Potentially one day, you know, following the Doug Tatum model, one day, hopefully it'll get larger than what I can fit on my shoulders, and I'll be looking for others to expand.
Right. Right. Yeah.
Yep, excellent. Well, you need to be in that Financial Executives International.
That's exactly
that
what I was thinking. Do you know about them?
I know the past chairman.
Well, we should.
We have them in here all the time.
Yes, we connect with them regularly.
I would appreciate it.
We should connect you. Yeah, they are. And they talk about all the time the lunch.
How CFOs and people in the top financial jobs typically change jobs on a cycle of an average of like 3 years.
It's between 18 and 36 months.
Yeah.
It truly is.
And so with Jim, I see Jim that comes in here regularly that always talks about what a value that organization is for exactly that purpose, because they're always sort of needing to know each other and network and
right.
see what's out there. And
because those lunches are happening
all the time.
Unfortunately, all the time.
All the time.
Robert, I wanted you to go into more detail about what's the distinction between what a controller does and what like a CFO does.
That's a great question. And the basic difference is the controllers tick and tie. They make sure everything is accurate, all the accounts are reconciled, closing the books. They produce the financial statements. A CFO does the analysis. Their role is to tell you what it means. Here's what's happened. Here's what I see. This could happen if these things happen. It's to take it that next step, anticipate what's coming down the road, helping answer the questions before they're asked. That's really the biggest difference.
So, and especially once you start growing quickly and you've gotten to a certain size, it becomes more and more important that you're having those analytical and projective conversations more frequently.
It absolutely is. And that's when I referred earlier to the ceiling, when they hit up against whatever that might be, $5 million, $10 million ceiling, that's exactly what's happening. They don't know what they don't know. They don't know how to ask.
And privately held companies like that, usually as they're growing, I mean, they have a pretty high retention rate for the most part. So the people that started with the company are the ones that are there as it's growing. And maybe they're not totally equipped to deal with the new company as it now is.
That's a huge challenge. And that's a harsh reality for the CEO. There are numbers of stories where CEOs, business owners, have outgrown their staff and have had to have those conversations with the folks that started it with them. Thank you very much, but you can't get us to that next level, whatever that role might be.
Yeah, I worked for a startup not too long ago. That I think when I got there, they maybe had been around for 5 years or something like that. It had grown pretty significantly, and the upper management was changing pretty dramatically. Like they kept, brought in a new CFO, and then the next thing you know, the CEO was gone, and because for exactly
different
those reasons.
Sets.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think even after
right.
I left, I've heard about more changes over there. And I think maybe they now have a management team in place that's right for their size. But I think that is kind of a sad thing about a growing business sometimes, one of my businesses along the way, I'm one of those people with 20 million crazy careers. And one of them was that I owned a bookstore. And, I was very adept at running a bookstore. I knew how to do my books, get my inventory in, cost things, sell things, interact with my customers, all of that stuff, make it look pretty, make good coffee. But if I had to grow to a chain, like if I ended up with two or three or four stores, I probably wouldn't have been the right person to run it.
That's right.
No matter how good my concept was.
That's a harsh reality.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really true. I think a lot of people, and there's also many people who are adept at starting businesses, but not running them.
So true.
And vice versa. So, it is a challenge, I think, to keep the right people in there.
Yes.
It's probably really fun for you to get to sort of be in a lot of different businesses.
It truly is. My clients span all industries,
yeah.
quite honestly. I think healthcare is the only industry I'm not in. The commonality is where they are, their stage of growth.
Sure.
They need more infrastructure. They need to be able to scale. That's the commonality. But my clients are literally across industries.
And are you still actively seeking new clients?
I have capacity for a couple more.
All right.
For the right ones.
If somebody wants to get a hold of CFO Navigator, how do they do that?
Can reach me at robert@cfo-navigator.com.
Okay.
Or go to my website, cfo-navigator.com.
Awesome. Anything else you want to add before we leave you and go over to John?
No, I'm
you're
fine.
Good.
Thank
you're good. All right. John West waiting patiently over here. Around the table we go. International management consultant. Tell us a little bit about what you do and how you got where you are, John.
Okay. Well, AmAsia 3 is a startup company, and Marco Chan is the CFO, CEO, and he grew up in Hong Kong and speaks Mandarin and Cantonese, and he and I both grew up in FedEx in customer service, and then I got promoted to be global quality manager for FedEx, and he got promoted to be general manager of Asia, and he started, he actually established FedEx in Asia, including in China. And then we separated from there and hadn't heard each other for years. And then I left FedEx on very friendly terms because I got as high as I could go and had my own consulting company. So a couple of years ago, he calls me out of the blue, and we were both living in Memphis, Tennessee, which is FedEx headquarters at the time. And says, come on over, have lunch. And so he tells me about how he's starting this AmAsia 3.
That's a good kind of lunch, right?
Right. That's a good kind of
those are the kind you want to have.
That's right.
Right. So I thought about it for a few weeks and said, sure, I'll help you, because I had some time to help him. So as it developed, he didn't have anybody in Atlanta. Kids are grown. Wife divorced me several years ago, so I'm free to go wherever I wanted. So I said, sure, I'll go over to Atlanta and help you start up over there instead of being here. So that's what brought me here. But our basic niche is we collectively, there's about 35 of us. Collectively, we have every management expertise there is that you can think of, logistics, supply chain, finance. You know, my niches primarily are customer satisfaction, overall assessments of large companies mainly, or large organizations. My favorite one is team building, because I've made a national agreement with Richard Petty Driving Experience.
Cool.
At 26 tracks across the U.S. And so the first 2 days, I do team building problem solving. I don't like the go out and zip line and everything. I want to do real things and solve problems. So I get them in a room. On the front end, they give me their list of 20 or 30 challenges they want to solve. We get in the room through nominal voting. We choose what's your priority. We do the list. And then for those 2 days, we solve as many of their problems as we can using my simple four-step process that we use. And then the third day, we go out to the track and have fun. And as team building, we simulate fueling the cars. These are actual NASCAR race cars.
Sweet.
And so they do go, you know, we only get to go 170, but
only.
So the professional drivers that drive it can go faster if they're alone. But at any rate, so we go out and we get in a classroom where we learn how to buckle each other in, how to simulate fueling the car. And then there's a team of five. We have at least five teams of five race cars out there. And it's like a race, you know, who can fuel the car fastest, who can buckle the guy in the right front. And one of your five team is one that's going to be the guy in the right seat. So then, based upon the five teams, whoever gets first goes out to the starting line first. Once all five cars are there, they literally race around the track.
Wow.
Come back in, repeat the process till all five people have gotten to sit in the right seat and drive, ride in the car. And then if you spend a little more money, you can also drive a car. And so it's a very fun, awesome process, quite frankly. I had the privilege in Memphis before I moved here of actually working with a race car driving experience. And so I would put people in and out of the cars and wash the cars and drive the cars and do everything. And so
if you need somebody to go with you on these trips, and like maybe I could be like the flag girl at the start, I would be so up for that. I'm just putting it out there, you know.
Okay, well, April 5th is the next time Richard Petty is in Atlanta at Atlanta Motor Speedway. So you're welcome to come down on April 5th. They'll be here, I think, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday that weekend. And unfortunately, this last time they were here, I think it was 2 weeks ago, remember the cold and rainy weekend?
Yeah.
They bought their exotics up also, as long as they're race cars. They've bought Lamborghinis and Ferraris and Porsches and Audis, souped-up ones, and you can actually drive those too. I don't know if they're bringing their exotics on April 5th, but there's nothing more fun than being out on the track.
That's really cool. So you said that your clients are primarily large enterprises. Is that
– Well, for AmAsia, that's not true. For me, it was true in my own consulting.
Okay.
But for AmAsia, we'll take anybody. And our primary niche in AmAsia, although we'll do any type of consulting anywhere around the world, our primary niche is helping people export from the U.S. To Asia and vice versa. We have about 7 people on the ground in Asia, so we can help Asia companies expand over here. The problem in the U.S. today, and Atlanta is that's especially true, is for companies to gain revenue, at some point, if they're going to get bigger, they really need to start exporting, especially if you're going to Asia and you don't understand the culture, you're going to need some help, and especially in China. China is all about relationships, and unless you have relationships, you aren't going to go anywhere.
Well, and what are you seeing in terms of the trade between the United States and Asia lately? I mean, what's the trend, John?
Well, I think it is increasing. There's all sorts of things that are needed over there, and the U.S. products, quite frankly, are very beloved over there, and they gobble them up. But, no, anybody can go over there. I mean, you know, anybody from Google to Walmart to – you know, car manufacturers, A to Z, all trying to go over there and do more. I think I was reading Chevy is what? A third of their business now is overseas, I believe, for all the money they're taking in. So
Chinese love Chevrolets.
There you go.
Yes.
Who knew?
Yes.
And India.
And Dubai. The interesting thing was, it's been a few years since I've been there, but that was one of their favorite cars.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Just goes to show you.
So what about from an entrepreneurial standpoint? You said you work with smaller companies as well. Are there particular niches that you've seen exploited very well?
Well, the two that have come to us recently are wineries from the West Coast. Chinese love wine. And they'll spend $150,000 literally on a weekend party.
Wow.
So there's lots of money to be made in wine. So that's going very well. Healthcare is the other interesting thing because heretofore in China, for instance, healthcare has been pretty much all government run and no private practice. China is at the point now where the 5-year plan, I think, has that they want to expand to make 20% of healthcare be private now instead of public and make it better, make it for the high end. So as I was telling one or two of you, if you saw 60 Minutes, this is not all good the way they're doing it, but this past weekend. But in the city of Kunming, which is in Yunnan province, which is the southernmost province right above Cambodia, it's a tropical province where people go to get warm like we do.
We go to Florida.
Right. They go to Yunnan province. Well, in Kunming, without anybody being there yet, they built the fourth largest airport in China. They've got an infrastructure started there of buildings and everything, but nobody there. And they're trying to start a healthcare tourism spot, especially for senior care, but really for any kind of healthcare. So this coming fall, they're having a big symposium over there. And so anybody in healthcare here in the U.S., for instance, because obviously we have a lot of experts, and anybody that wants to go over there to this symposium and be like a sponsor for a few thousand dollars can really get their foot in the door. In China, as I said, you better have relationships. If you don't have relationships, you could be the best expert in the world and you just aren't going one inch, you know, into their markets. So we've got a large government sponsor involved in this. It's for a few thousand dollars, people can get right away, establish these late relationships and get in the door in healthcare. And it's from A to Z. I mean, they need hospitals, they need rehabilitation, just anything you can name. They're really, really hurting in healthcare over there. It's just, respiratory is another big thing, especially in Beijing, and where it's just off the charts in
with
smog.
The pollution, right.
I mean, they had to literally close the Beijing airport. I think it was for 2 days, 2 weeks ago. The smog was so bad.
The visibility.
Wow. That's horrifying.
It's really bad.
Wow.
So there's tons of opportunities.
Lots of opportunity. That's great. Thanks for sharing all of that with us.
Oh, sure.
And so, John, if people want to get in touch with AmAsia and work with you guys, how do they find you?
My email is jwest, J-W-E-S-T, at amasia3.net, A-M-A-S-I-A, number 3.net.
I think it's kind of interesting because I can imagine that a lot of the companies you work with probably need secure data transferability, and they might even, some of them might even need some CFO help. So you guys should take a minute and chat after the show.
Let's talk.
Right.
Let's
you know, talk. Come on. I think there's a lot. It's always interesting bringing sort of a disparate group of business people together in a room, because every time we do that, we find out they're not so disparate.
Well, that's the advantage of the World Trade Center and the Metro Atlanta Chamber of Commerce. Metro Atlanta Chamber of Commerce is exports is really like high on their priority.
Absolutely.
Now, and they're really gung ho, and I'm helping them as a member in global commerce. I'm on their outbound committee and trying to help them really expand in the whole metro area here exporting.
That's great. Well, since we've got the brand spanking new international terminal, we
That's
should
right.
be all thinking more internationally these days.
Well,
here
it's
in
a,
Atlanta.
It's a global world now. Everything is global. So
and the new Porsche North American headquarters is right next to the airport with a racetrack.
That whole Aerotropolis, is that what they're calling
right.
it down there?
Yes.
That's pretty cool. I think
it's going to be that in 10 years, that's going to be like a whole other city down
yeah.
there.
You should see how John is lighting up every time he talks about cars. He's like the room is like brightly lit with his enthusiasm for cars. I love it. We're about out of time, but I want to thank our guests again, Dan Bradbury, John West, and Robert Stevens for joining us. Thank you so much, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
That's about it. We also obviously want to thank Lilia and our sponsor, World Trade Center Atlanta. You can learn more about them by visiting WTCAtlanta.com. I'm Dana Barrett.
And I'm Elizabeth Gordon. You've been listening to Business Radio X, a proud 2013 member of Central Atlanta Progress. Learn more about Central Atlanta Progress at AtlantaDowntown.com. Stay tuned for more great shows here on Business Radio X.